Welcome to the SME Community Podcast by Tipperary Local Enterprise Office with me, Aisling Hurley, the Business Fairy.
So 2023 has been designated European Year of Skills by the EU Commission. And on Thursday, the 15th of November, Leo Tipperary are having an event. It's a panel discussion about how to grow local talent. So in advance of that, today we're speaking with Sinead Hennigan about a huge issue amongst the SME community, which is how do we attract and retain talent? Currently, 3 in 4 EU companies are having difficulty in sourcing workers with the skills that that organisation needs, and this is leading to prolonged and chronic shortages of skills, as we all know, making it more difficult for us to deliver on our strategic objectives. So this looks like it's set to continue and maybe worsen. So it's a perfect timing for our guest today, who is, as I said, Sinead Hennigan, who is the dynamic lead and CEO of Landi, LANDDI.ie. Sinead is a visionary leader who is reshaping the training and development landscape. Formerly the Irish Institute of Training and Development, founded in 1969, Landi is the professional body that represents members concerned with learning and talent development in Ireland. The organisation has over 2,000 members that work across all businesses and industries. They're contributors to national policy on L&D related matters. And Sinead also runs the Landi L&D SkillNet, which provides grant-aided funding for L&D professionals. So they're focused on developing SME leadership for the new world of work. Sinead, thanks so much for joining us. Did I miss anything with that intro?
No. My modesty, really, I don't know. I hope I live up to your introduction.
I think it's an Irish thing, isn't it? Nobody likes taking a compliment.
I know. It's a really exciting time for the industry. And as you say, Learning and Development Institute, we rebranded from the Irish Institute of Training and Development last year. And really, you know, the IITD as it was established in 1969. So over the years, it's just very interesting to see the way the landscape has evolved, you know, and that the what was always a very narrow, almost vocational perspective, if you like, on training, really broadened out to encompass so many agenda items, and how learning was about so much more than just the actual act of training, if you like, and how it has now become a really, really key strategic pillar in all aspects of organizational performance. And that's exactly why it is so critical to having a well-skilled, available workforce who can contribute to the growth of the organization. And it's very interesting, you know, really in recent years, the whole HR agenda has kind of almost split in two. So there are people now in organizations who are dedicated to the HRM, the management of people, the employment law, the employee experience, the pensions, all of that kind of stuff. And then there are other people who are looking at the HRD, the development of people. So again, as I said, looking at, you know, organizational performance through people, culture, leadership, all of those sort of things. And the point at which those two agendas intersect is the recruitment for skills and talent.
Brilliant. I love that phrase, the development of people. It's such a nice holistic type phrase or word, isn't it? And I think for people who are listening, actually, this acronym L&D has kind of popped up. I suppose it's fairly new and some people mightn't be aware of it. But as Sinead was explaining, it's learning and development. So it's about developing your talent or your team or people that you're working with you. Isn't that right? Mm.
Oh, absolutely. And the reality is that even for very small businesses, like small businesses are competing with big businesses and other small businesses. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So and so all of the same kind of unprecedented challenges that that all organizations are facing are almost they're almost more challenging, if you like, for smaller companies. And things like, you know, technological advancements that are completely reshaping industries and the way in which the global economy is becoming increasingly interconnected, that makes it even a greater imperative to have a highly skilled and a really adaptable workforce. And in fact, in ways, I think it's that piece about having an adaptable workforce. Like, if you, I think if you want an adaptable workforce, you have to have an adaptable workplace. And I think that is potentially the one advantage that smaller SMEs can have over larger organizations. They have much greater autonomy over the design of their work and how they structure their business. And that in turn then enables the employee experience to be more flexible, if you like. But certainly the demand for highly skilled talent, it continues to outpace supply.
Yeah, the market's very hot at the minute.
Yeah, very hot.
I think like we've both been around a while and all the changes that have taken place over the years. Like, I mean, it's incredible to think that the company you're ahead of was founded in 1969 when things were so different. I mean, even looking at women entering the workforce and, you know, so many changes we've seen. What do you think have been, I suppose, the most amazing changes over the years?
Oh, I think the design of work definitely has been the most significant change. And I think there's a number of drivers for that, you know, like the need for organizations to understand that to advance the strategy and to know the skills and capability of their employees and to get some kind of competitive advantage, they have to make it attractive to work there. I think the biggest change definitely has been the design of work around in order to facilitate the getting some kind of pipeline of talent. There's no question about the fact that there is still a huge percentage of the available work population that are not in the workplace. Yeah. And the OECD, I think it was, did some research a couple of years ago looking at in Ireland, and they were saying that, you know, only 63% of the available workforce were in the workplace. And if you take that out, sort of split that out into genders, if you like, I think it was something like 55% of the available female population were in the workplace, whereas 75% of the available male population were in the workplace. And if you look at it, go back to that gender thing and dive a little deeper into that, they discovered that only 32% of the available female workplace within the age between the ages of 32 and 48, I think it was, were in the workplace. So there's a huge piece there around gender, the age profile of people within that, around why are those people not in the workplace? And you can make some assumptions around that. You know, it's about it's about trying to manage the challenges in other aspects of your life. It's about prioritizing somebody in the home to perhaps pursue a career in order to maintain some other equilibrium in other aspects of our lives. So they're the sort of things that employers have had to deal with. If they want to get that available workforce back into the workplace, they have had to redesign the way work happens. And I mean, obviously, everybody knows, you know, COVID was the big accelerant of that. And it sort of catapulted us into a place that we never thought possible in terms of getting some sort of momentum going around really looking at how can we run our businesses in a much more flexible way if we are to be able to bring people into the organization. So that has without question been the most significant change, the design of work, and the fact that we now have a global workforce and a national workforce. You know, it doesn't matter now. You can have a small business in what would be perceived to be quite remote areas and still have a very available workforce. And that has all been facilitated and enabled by technology.
Yeah, I think we're so lucky.
That's the other huge,
change. Technology. It's just an amazing time to be around, really, I think. You know? It's amazing to think that there's that many women in particular that are there potentially available for work. And
there's a whole hidden workforce out there. You know, I mean, we might talk in a few minutes about inclusive workplaces, you know, that's the other one, you know, employing people who have disabilities. But definitely there is like there's a massive squeeze on talent and a pipeline of employees. But there's also a huge available workforce out there if organizations can look, you know, more broadly at how they are going about engaging with them.
Yeah, brilliant. So that's a bit of good news. Recently, funny, leading into the next point, DCU and Trinity undertook research which revealed that organizations are altering their approach to hiring new talent. And you were involved with that, Sinead.
Yes, so as you mentioned earlier,
we are the promoter organisation for the Learning and Development SkillNet, and SkillNet Ireland gave us funding through our network to commission this piece of research. So historically, we would have done some excellent research with Professor David Collings, who is now in Trinity, formerly of DCU, and Dr. John McMacken, also in DCU. So a couple of years ago, we did some research with them, also funded by SkillNet Ireland, into looking at the role of learning and development in enabling the workforce of the future. And that was very significant. It got a lot of traction. It was published in Sloan Management Journal. It was, you know, it got on the radar of across the EU with CEDEFOP and that. And then emerging from that, there became this. It was very apparent that organisations needed to move to this skills first HR approach. So that then became the second piece of research that that they commissioned. And skills first, if you like, is kind of almost a new buzzword almost in human resource management. And essentially, it's about looking at how organizations can take a different perspective on how or what, if you like, they need from their talent. So instead of hiring for qualifications and a lot of years of experience, so you have to have this degree and 3 years of experience in this, they're really looking very much at how what are the needs of the business right now, what is the exact capability we need, and taking a much more proportional perspective on things. So do we need somebody who has a degree? You know, would it be okay if we had somebody who was able to demonstrate that they can actually do it? And I think it's because the trends now are really that the pace is just so dynamic out there. You need to be able to have an agile workforce. So you can't have linear career paths anymore, if you like. You know, the idea that you'd start here and then in 2 years we'll go to that level and then another 2 years we'll go to some other level, that is all that's not happening anymore. What's happening is that things are so dynamic that you need somebody who can do this now, and maybe in 6 months' time we need them to be doing something else. So the idea of taking a skills first HR approach allows organizations to really operate just in time and say, okay, what do we need now, and what is the volume of development somebody needs to have in order to do what we need, you know? And and really, as we were saying, you know, so like 3 in 4 EU companies, this was one of the things that came out of that research, 3 in 4 EU companies have difficulty in finding workers with the skills they need. And that skills landscape is, absolutely incredible. But the skills landscape is just changing so quickly. And, you know, so therefore, building employee skills and capabilities is really like almost the number one priority for HR leaders, you know. And the other very interesting stat that came out of that research, now, obviously, this possibly would be larger organizations, but nonetheless, it still applies, that almost 40% of respondents to PwC's last recent CEO Pulse survey felt that their businesses would not be viable in 10 years if they continued with their current plan.
Wow.
10 years.
That's such a short time frame. Wow.
Therefore, the organizations have to take a totally different approach to hiring talent. And so this shift then to skills first HR is what emerged from that initial piece of research. And that was the basis on which they decided that it merited much further exploration.
But I'm delighted though to hear a focus on skills, because to be honest, you know, over the last few years, I think we've been hyper focused on degrees, masters. Now it's getting to this insane thing where you nearly have to have a PhD, you know, to get a job. It's ridiculous the amount of money you have to invest in an education. As you say, none of us are going to be in a set job for life anymore, because everything is so dynamic. And now, you know, with the appearance of AI, as we were talking about in our last episode, everything is changing so fast. You know, I felt we were kind of hurtling towards, you know, like the French economy, where it's very much knowledge driven, but like if you need a plumber or a carpenter or a joiner, forget it, you know. It's brilliant, I think, now that we are looking at skills.
No, definitely. And I mean, if we were just to talk about it a little, there's a number of elements to it that, you know, like it just makes so much sense when you think about it. So if you think about it from a recruitment point of view, well, that's one thing, but it also has huge implications in a positive way for the retention agenda.
Yeah.
So, for example, you know, we could talk a little bit about, but one of the elements of Skills First HR is the capability to do a kind of a skills audit, you know. So,
yeah.
But if you are able to get that skills audit piece done and you know, eventually your employees will have a little kind of a, almost a kind of a skills passport, if you like. But what it does do is it allows much better collaboration across departments within a business from the point of view of understanding what is the capability that already exists within the organization. So there's a whole lot of hidden talent within an organization. So if you think about this from a retention point of view, there are people in companies who are doing jobs that they are happy with, but perhaps maybe becoming slightly bored, perhaps, or feeling that they've kind of done as much as they can do in that space, perhaps feeling they're ready for a different challenge, that they're not playing to their strengths, et cetera, et cetera. And the implication for that is that inevitably they will leave the business at some point. Whereas this idea of taking a skills first HR approach, where organizations can conduct a skills audit and understand the existing capability that they have, capability that people have acquired in all aspects of their life. So, you know, Josh Burson a few years ago was talking about this whole thing of learning in the flow of life, and the idea that you are acquiring capability and skills and learning in all of your touch points, not just within the organization. So people are bringing knowledge to the workplace that they are gaining in other contexts. And what that means is that there are needs within organizations that can be filled by people who are already in the business if the organization knew that that capability was there. So this taking this retention space perspective as well to adopting a skills first HR model means that people who are potentially at risk of leaving the business in fact may not leave, because they can be re-diverted, if you like, into another aspect of work, perhaps a different project or perhaps a different area of the business. And all of these things collectively ensure that you retain people, that you are filling the gaps that you need right now, and that you are growing the talent, like people who are moving into these new roles or working on these new projects, essentially they are growing their skill set as well. So it really supports the whole idea of, you know, knowledge exchange, building tacit knowledge from the point of view of an organization, and particularly now in a small business, you know, you don't have the cost of going out and recruiting and hiring somebody else, and the almost the downtime that it takes to bring a new person up to speed on some of the, as I said, the tacit stuff, just the way of working in the organization, the culture, the core business area. So all of those things, you know, this skills first approach is really effective at matching people to the anticipated longer term commercial needs of the business, while it also works very well to identify how people with competencies in one field could be redeployed to another, if you like, within the organization.
Oh, it's brilliant. And it's, you know, for someone listening now, I love this whole idea of a skills audit. How would they go about it, Sinead, or where do you think
I
start?
Think this is, yeah. Now, this is where people start to run for the hills. But the fact is, AI, let's just use the word AI. People say, oh my God, it's like they have the same reaction when you say data. Oh, data. Oh, AI. No, no, no. But the fact is, yes, exactly. There are all forms of really accessible AI tools out there now that does all this heavy lifting for you. You know, there really are, like, the pace of progression with AI is just absolutely phenomenal. And I mean, if you look at the extent of AI tools and capability that's facilitated by AI now, that's out there. And apparently in the States, they will say that they have a kind of a pipeline 3 years out of AI that they haven't actually released yet. So, I mean, AI is going to change the world. And people are afraid of it, but we shouldn't be afraid of it. We really should see it as an enabler. And this is one of the things, you know, the extent to which we, you know, organizations are really depending on technology. And as I said, if you go back to the, you know, what happened during COVID, I mean, before COVID, people said, well, we'd never be able to use technology for work. That would just not work in our business. And we need everybody on site all of the time. And we have to all be sitting in the room, and we have to all live locally and all that kind of stuff. And then they discovered, you know what, we can do this. We can all use technology very quickly. We can get people up to speed and get people comfortable with the use of technology. And the idea of conducting skills first audits using AI is not difficult. Now, there's a number of things that would have to happen. You know, generally speaking, the organisation will need to have some kind of a sort of a North Star, was what David Collins and John McMacken talked about when they did the initial piece of research, whereby there is a very clear strategy within the organisation, within the leadership team, that is well articulated across the business and everybody understands the common goals that we are all working towards. That would be the first thing. And the second thing then is the idea of having some kind of a skills taxonomy, you know, kind of a shared language, a framework almost for describing and capturing skills right across the organization.
Brilliant.
So, you know, yeah, and they you know, skills taxonomies really are kind of essential building blocks towards maybe realizing some of the more important benefits of this kind of skills first HR practices. So, but it will support enhanced mobility, these career opportunities that we talked about, and as I said, you know, the capability to redeploy people with relevant skills to where they're most needed. Now, that can be challenging to develop, but as I said, there is a lot of technology out there to support that. And really, the challenge is not how do you do it; it's about getting everybody in the business on board to agree the language, you know. But yeah. So then, as I said, you'd move on from that then to doing some kind of a skills audit where you develop a kind of a baseline understanding of the skills you currently have in the organization, and it's really like coming up with a sort of a skills inventory, if you like. And the other thing is this just-in-time, agile, very responsive approach, companies and people in the organization need to really get on board with the idea then that perfection does not have to be the enemy of good, and that good enough is good enough to get you up and running. You know, in terms of doing a skills audit, you're only going to get, so, you know, to a point with it, but using technology will allow an organization to produce some kind of a skills passport, or as I said, you know, kind of a talent card. And in a small business, particularly, just start with conversations.
Yeah.
What skills do you have? What skills have you acquired outside of the organization? You don't want to lose those people to the market. And it does definitely rely on, to some extent, on self-assessment, and that can be tricky, but you can also, again, go back to the technology and present people with a kind of a menu of skills, if you like, if they're struggling to get started, and just let them identify the ones they feel that they have, you know.
I think it's brilliant.
Yeah, so it can be done if people don't overthink it, if you like.
Yeah, brilliant. That's the whole thing. I think sometimes we talk ourselves out of doing these great things.
Yeah.
We're thinking of everything that can go wrong. Just go for it. Well, how do you feel? There's another buzzword that's all over the place. I'm dying to hear your thoughts on it. You know, micro-credentials and short courses. I suppose, again, thinking about skill sets as opposed to the, you know, having 4 degrees, master, whatever.
Yeah.
What do you think about those? And do you think SMEs can leverage those educational opportunities maybe?
I do think they can, yes. And I think the idea of giving people currency against their learning interventions is really important. And for some people, that is going to be more important than others. So, for example, if we tie in both of those things, the piece we've just been talking about where you might have a small particular need, you just need someone to have a certain volume of learning. It doesn't need to be a PhD. We just need someone who can do this, and this. And that is where you'll have an appropriate, you know, level or volume of development that may well fit with a micro credential. Whereas there are other people who perhaps are coming with perhaps not quite a comprehensive portfolio of qualifications, and a certification is very important for those people to allow them to get on that progression ladder and to build their qualification portfolio. However, I do think that we are at a tricky place at the moment about that currency piece. So I think there's a lot of language being used to describe particular learning interventions. So the language of certificate, diploma, professional diplomas, professional certificates, this, that, and the other. And I think for people who are not in the space, so like in learning and development at LNDI, we have a very, very long history of working with the universities. We have formal qualifications, diplomas with UCC. We've been working with UCC since the 1980s, if you like, on developing formal qualifications. Last year, we developed and launched, again, with the support of SkillNet Ireland, a strategic master's in learning and development with our colleagues in DCU. And like I am, believe it or not, nearly 24 years with LDI. Well, I love it every day.
Yeah.
And it's been totally different. Like you asked me at the beginning, that the way the thing has changed over the years, it's a totally different job now to what I was doing then. But I am used to dealing with this, or universities, the way colleges work. It's very, very complex. And I think there is a danger now that people who are not familiar with the way higher education works will make an assumption that they are getting a qualification, whereas in fact they're not.
Yeah.
So I think there is a real place for small, modular, little nuggets of learning to be recognized in some way. But I think there is there's a potential for a lot of confusion around the exact currency of the output. So something that can be called a diploma may only actually be 5 credits in a micro-credential. And somebody may think they have a diploma, whereas a diploma is awarded with the accumulation of 60 credits. And you know what I mean? So I think there is a risk that there are people who will assume they're getting a formal qualification where they are not. And the other thing is that there's a lot of work to be done on the design and the architecture of them. At the moment, largely they are not stackable. If you do something in one unit college, it won't necessarily allow you to leverage that in another. And I would just have a fear that people will engage in a whole multitude of micro credentials and they will end up with a basket of things and actually no cumulative qualification at the end of it. So they absolutely have a place for recognizing little modular pieces of learning, but I think there needs to be much better work done out in the market around communicating exactly what somebody is acquiring at the end of it. And if they do want to undertake a portfolio of micro-credentials, they will need to be clear in advance how they will be able to stack those and cumulatively work towards a qualification.
Yeah, it's a bit of work to be done there. And sometimes I think it's
people who are early days, though. It's early days.
People to be aware, I suppose, more than anything.
Yeah.
And we know, Leo Tipperary in particular are brilliant at running really relevant current training programs to support businesses. Are there any other initiatives that SMEs can tap into to help them, with the town decision?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, as the saying went, we never had it so good. There are so many funded and state supported opportunities out there for people to acquire learning. So SkillNet Ireland has networks all over the country, sectoral networks and regional networks, and they are offering any amount of partially and fully funded programs for anybody who is interested in this. They fund employers, so it is an ideal opportunity for small businesses particularly to engage with the networks and to understand what network can meet the needs. There are so many of them that, it nearly doesn't matter what particular need you'd have, there will be somebody who could help. So that's the first one. As you say, the Leos are doing loads of great stuff and they're all over the country as well. The ETBs have a huge portfolio of activity. A lot of that is fully funded or certainly largely funded. The colleges now, but back to this thing about the universities, there are a lot of opportunities through higher education now. Springboard programs, all kinds of different collaborations between higher education and industry providers now around delivering funded development opportunities. So that's all available to people. And then there are other things, like mentoring. It's not just about physically sitting in the classroom. There are, there's great mentoring opportunities out there. And in fact, often that's something people really need, maybe more so than the formal qualification. They might be undertaking a program, but they may really value and benefit from just a mentor who will say to you, well, what did you do in the program last week? Or what are you working on in your workplace? And to help people to maybe build a better bridge between how they would transfer the learning outcomes and get much more qualitative impact, if you like, from the program into the business, and for people to understand what that means for them personally. And I think there's so much, it's back to the point I was making earlier about, people running for the hills when you talk about data or AI and those things. When you talk about return on investment, that people run for the hills when you talk about that too, because immediately they think about really complex algorithms or hard sums around trying to do calculations. But in fact, really ROI now needs to be about return on impact. That's what it needs to be about, impact. And if you have a good mentor or somebody who will do a bit of coaching with you, that is a really key enabler of impact around how you can transfer learning back into your organization. Or even if you're not on a development program, just how you can create better impact for yourself and be much more innovative in how you are performing your role. So identifying people who could be good mentors or a coach is also very important.
Yeah, I actually do a lot of mentoring work with the Leos, and it's brilliant. Genuinely, people get so much from it. So, you know, if you're listening to this and you haven't thought about mentoring before, it's a brilliant place to start. And it's great that you're mentioning it today, because you can get answers to questions that have been driving you insane maybe for months, you know, and you can get someone that will support you and help you and keep you accountable, which is really brilliant.
Sometimes all you need is a sounding board where you can articulate what's in your head out loud, and that brings a better degree of coherency.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder as well why mentoring is not more prevalent. No, I don't just mean the Leos. Like, I'm thinking there was a great film, I don't know if you saw it years ago, with Robert De Niro and Anne Hathaway, and I think it was called The Intern. Around 2015 maybe. But I just thought it was a fantastic story within the film. So basically, she was playing the part of this girl that set up typical tech startup, you know, I think it was e-commerce or something like that, and she's young, so she doesn't have all the life experience or the bigger business experience. And then Robert De Niro played this character who was well on, had retired, and really just wanted something to do with his time but didn't want to be tied up every day. So he provided this kind of sounding board mentoring service to her, you know. And I just thought, why do we not do that? I mean, there are so many people out there who still have so much to give and are kind of forced into retiring, aren't they, you know,
and want to do this. Like, we have, so we're a membership organization, but we have member to member mentoring, peer mentoring. It's part of the member offer. It's free of charge to members. They just, and we have a kind of a database of members are published on our website, people who have put themselves forward and said, yes, I would do some mentoring. And we have a kind of a little framework around it, you know, but it might be a coffee, it might be a few calls, it could be emailing, it could be a combination of a number of things. But it's very interesting, you know, the mentors who have put themselves forward upload a little bio, and they are at people who are at all stages of their career. So some people are at early stage career, they're at a particular inflection point, maybe they're coming off a grad program, maybe they're at a kind of a mid-level, they want to move to a senior level, and they will identify somebody on that mentoring panel who might be at that point that they're at and could help them, or have got passed through that point, if you like, and could help them with how to do that. But there are also people who are very, very senior in organizations, or people who are perhaps coming towards the end of their career, and a number of things can happen. Maybe they are highly experienced and highly capable, but perhaps they want to perhaps go out on their own, and they will look to be mentored by somebody else who perhaps is way younger than them but is already out on their own. Or they might find that they want to perhaps get a better handle on AI, for example, back to our own friend, and they will look to be mentored by somebody who is much, much younger than them and could be perceived to be far less experienced. However, they are much closer and really on top of that particular agenda, and they will look to be mentored by people who are far younger than them. So, you know, I think this is where, again, particularly in small organizations, this is so easy to do in a small business. People know the people in the business. They know if there's an opportunity for, you know, Aisling to have a few coffees with Sinead around a particular question, and where it's all part of the knowledge sharing. And again, go back to the thing about the skills audit. How do we know what skills capability is in the business? Well, this is a great way to find out. As I was saying, start with conversations. So you can be mentored by people who are within the business or people who are outside of the business, but you don't have to be mentored by somebody who you perceive to be far more senior than you. You know, you can sometimes come up with a question, put a hand up and say, look, who would be actually a good person for me to talk to about this?
Yeah, I think it's such a brilliant idea. It's really just about us allowing the time for that to happen, isn't it? Really, like everything was.
For younger people or people who are in their career, it really validates them in terms of where they are. If somebody else comes to them and says, do you think we could do a little bit of work on this together? Maybe you could give me a steer. You know, so it's really, really, really good way to do that. Yeah.
Oh, it's brilliant and great for building teams as well, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
So another subject that's very close to both our hearts is inclusivity.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Just, you know, as we were talking earlier on off air several times, like shockingly, disabled people are only half as likely to be in employment as others of working age. You know, yeah, and networking and company culture are, you know, often play a big role in job decisions. So how can SMEs, do you think, create an attractive and inclusive workplace culture? You know, I think we're missing lots of opportunities. I think lots of people, you know, with intellectual disabilities or physical or hidden disabilities. I myself have a hidden disability, and I think they have so much to give, but it's like, on paper, they're just written off straight away, you know?
Yeah.
Like how can we change that, do you think?
Well, if you talk about a hidden workforce, that's where you can start.
There is a huge hidden workforce out there, excuse me, and people with physical disabilities and people with intellectual disabilities. And if you go back to the comments we were making earlier about the extent to which the adoption of technology has allowed us to advance the way of working, the design of work, how people interact with each other, this is the big enabler of bringing that hidden workforce into the organization. There are people who in the past would have been prevented from traveling because it would have been too complex. Perhaps they need a particular type of environmental design to enable them to work, and some organizations, just the infrastructure was not able to accommodate that. But now the fact that we are all working away with technology means that we can absolutely create a much more inclusive culture. And I mean, that's really what it's about. It's about creating an inclusive workplace culture. So that is very simply just one where everybody is accepted and valued, you know. So
yeah.
Like Inclusion Ireland have done a lot of research in this, and last week they launched their employment code of practice, which is, they call it Make It Work, and it really is guidelines for employers to make inclusive employment a reality for people with intellectual disabilities, the particular focus of their work. But they would make the point, and I would agree with this very much. I think employers are afraid. I think largely the reason there are not more people with disabilities in the workplace is because employers are fearful, or they are apprehensive about recruiting people with disabilities in case they get it wrong, in case someone says the wrong thing, and then we're going to be all cancelled and we'll be all over social media, and somebody will say, oh my God, don't work for them, they're terrible people. And yeah, but like, we really need to just acknowledge those concerns and address them so that things can progress, and that we can create a culture of openness, and that learning can be fostered, you know. And I do think that the most inclusive workplaces are the ones that are open to learning, and open to not always getting it right, but willing to try. And I also think, I mean, you have declared that you have a hidden disability. I have a son with Down syndrome, so he has an intellectual disability. And I think that allows us to say that I think people who don't have a disability are far more fearful of the getting it wrong than the people who do. You know, I think people who have disabilities are just very happy to work with an organization and support people who are open. If you have that open conversation and open to the feedback and the input from individuals around how we can make this work. So I think that's the thing, that to, you know, create some kind of inclusive culture that acknowledges that diversity is a progression of the modern workplace, and that we are just trying to create an environment where the inherent worth and dignity and strength of all people are acknowledged and welcomed. And that is a good business decision. So
yeah.
I think there are guidelines, like, I don't know if there's a mechanism to share links or anything, but if people go on to the Inclusion Ireland website, that employment code of practice, it's called Make It Work, that is there. And there are guidelines for employers and there are guidelines for employees, you know. So yeah, but I think the most important thing is give it a go. Just like if an employer says, we can do this, okay, we need some help to do it, but we can do it. And there are some very good models out there as well. I have been a mentor for years with an initiative called Project Search, which is a collaboration between CARE in Newbridge and Naas Hospital, where they bring in a group of people every year, 10 or 12 people. They rotate them around different business areas of the hospital. So they do some work with finance, they do a bit of work with dietetics, they do some work with housekeeping, all of those kind of things. And they are also doing some you know, obviously formal learning as part of that. But in the end, they go through this program for a year, and in the end, they are placed in employment and they decide, I want to work 10 hours a week in retail. I want to work 20 hours a week in an office. I want to work full time. But there is a way of working for everybody. And I think the biggest thing is employers need to not be afraid.
That's it. Just grasp it. And actually,
yeah,
I suppose one thing to ask around that, if they decide listening to us, okay, do you know what? I'd love to give this a go. And I think a lot of people would actually love to try it. But then they're like, oh, where do I go? Or where do I start? Or is there any form of support there? So if I was to take somebody one day a week or 2 days a week or whatever, how do I deal with that? I'm only a small business. I don't have a HR department. I suppose these are all the things kind of running through their heads. Is there a support mechanism?
And the National Disability Authority, they have there are so many initiatives to support organizations, both financial and otherwise, you know, to support organizations who want to bring somebody in. And a lot of people, you know, who need different levels of support. Some of them will have job buddies coming with them. Job coaches, they come as part of the initiative. And as I said, the National Disability Authority, Inclusion Ireland, they're a great place to start. And, you know, if anybody wants to contact us, we can put them in touch with people. But like, as I said, different people have different needs. Some people just have physical need. And that's just really about being able to design work so that they can work. Perhaps if they prefer to work at home, they can work fully remotely. Other people will need perhaps some technology enablement to support their perhaps manual dexterity, or some people will need some very small modifications made to a work environment in an office to enable them to physically access it. And then, as we said, other people perhaps will have an intellectual disability and they will need different kinds of supports. But there are so many supports out there for organisations, and they would be two really good places to start. National Disability Authority and our Inclusion Ireland.
Oh, brilliant. We will share the links. We do share links actually at the end of the podcast in the notes. So we'll stick those in for people. Sinead, just thinking there as you were talking, what about the importance of, you know, psychological safety and feeling safe to discuss things at work?
Yeah, I think this is now a huge topic, and, you know, the whole area of psychological safety, where people are leaders, first of all, are creating a culture in organizations, and employees feel that they are in a safe place where they can try new things, that it's a risk-free environment, that there will be no consequences of failing, in inverted commas, and that instead of punishing people for failure, that the failure is something that we are learning from. And it really plays out when we look at the challenges in particular sectors now around where people feel they cannot speak up.
Yeah.
For fear of consequence, or where people have spoken up and nobody has listened. And then we have these catastrophic outcomes. And it was an interesting thing, you know, we had a conference last year and Stuart Woodard from the Maturity Institute in the UK was over, and we had asked him to look at the whole area of investors and to what extent, and this is interesting for small businesses too, to what extent does the whole people development agenda influence the decision of investors? And their research found that it influenced it in two ways. One, in they look at the capability of leaders, so the whole area of leadership development. But the second area was the culture in the organization of a willingness to take risks, because there is no growth without risks. You have to be prepared to take risks if you want growth. And that is why psychological safety is so important, that people have to feel, I am able to try something new, or to make some suggestions, or to call out something that's not working. And in the former examples, that if it fails, there's no major consequence for me, that we are just going to learn from that. And that in the latter ones, then, that somebody will listen to me. And Professor Amy Edmondson, she is with Harvard. She's the world's leading organizational psychologist, and the whole area of psychological safety and failing well is her area of expertise. So just a little plug, we are bringing her here to Ireland on the 6th of December to our conference in Croke Park, and we are just so excited. It's the first time she's ever spoken in Ireland, and that if people are interested in hearing a little bit more about psychological safety and how to create a culture where you can support people to fail and learn from the failures, you can come in here on the 6th of December. But that is really critical for a whole myriad of agenda items in organisational performance through people.
Brilliant. Such an important point to make. Thanks. I just, while I think of it, want to give a shout out to an amazing business we have in Tipperary called Molly Madra. And they design cards, and it was set up by two sisters, Katrina and Maura. And one of them has Down syndrome, and the cards are just gorgeous. So I'd encourage anybody who's listening to hop on to Molly Madra and support Katrina and Maura in what they're doing. I mean, really, there's so few female entrepreneurs, and then to have a female entrepreneur that has Down syndrome is just incredible. It's a really brilliant story. Great. So maybe give them a support.
Maybe they'll have we'll get some Christmas cards.
So the great shout out to them. I know they'll appreciate it. It's been absolutely brilliant talking to you, Sinead. We always say at the end, is there anything, you know, what advice you'd like to leave people with, or what would you, I suppose, thought of the day, or what would you like to say to people before we finish up that we can attract and retain?
Look, I think this is for employers and employees, that developing people is the key to having a sustainable business. That is it. It allows people to progress. It allows organizations to meet their needs. And there is no excuse now for anybody or any organization to say, look, we can't afford it, or we can't find what we want. There are so many opportunities out there now, funded, online, self-directed, self-paced, classroom-based. There's any need for anybody can be met now. And as I said, that is the key to sustainable business and to progression is learning.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been good. The time has flown. My goodness.
It's absolutely brilliant. If you would like to find out more about Sinead and what she does and what Landy does, you can chop onto their website, which is landdi.ie. You can also find them on Facebook under L and D Institute, and Instagram under L and D Institute as well. Thank you so much to Aoife Horan and Madeline Ryan of Leo Tipperary. They're down in the office in Clonmel. If you want to pop in and see them, obviously make an appointment, you can reach them on their website, localenterprise.ie/Tipperary. And they're obviously across all platforms, including Twitter at Leo Tipperary. Don't forget about the event on the 15th of November, wherein you can learn more about the sort of topics that Sinead and I were talking about today. If you'd like to talk to us, you can reach us at thebusinessfairy.ie or Twitter and Instagram at TBF Central using the hashtag SME Community Podcast. And finally, thank you very much to Derry Luttrell, our sound engineer, who always does such a great job for us. And thank you for listening. See you next time.
The SME Community Podcast is an initiative by Tipperary Local Enterprise Office. It is produced by the Business Fairy Digital Marketing Agency, and it's hosted by me, Aisling Hurley. You can talk to us on Twitter at TBF Central, and you can also talk to Tipperary Local Enterprise Office on Leo Tipperary.